This is Car Expert.
It's a collaborative effort between Korea, Germany, and the US, so that might be why it's a bit of a hodgepodge of styles.
The Express won't help you avoid a crash, but it will still do something to protect you if you do end up in that accident, and that's just not clear from a zero-star rating.
Subaru deriving 71% of its sales from the US is just mind-blowing to me.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and a big hello to Mike Costello.
G'day, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hello, hello.
I suppose we'll start off with a bit of sad news this week. I was absolutely shocked to hear of the passing of Sabine Schmitz just a couple of days ago. I don't know about you guys, but she was such an inspirational lady to many people. And I didn't know she was battling cancer for the last 3 years, like 51 years of age. Just a bit of a shock to the motorsport industry, no doubt.
And, I mean, it's devastating. And she seemed like such a good person. And, of course, Mandy, you would know better than most that this really is one of the more patriarchal industries going around, the automotive industry. It's still very male-dominated, much to its detriment. And for, you know, Sabine not only to be a champion, queen of the Nürburgring, but to also be a woman in such a blokey industry made her, I imagine, such a influential, inspiring figure. And to lose her is just is tragic. It really is.
Like to follow on from those comments, like I actually almost got emotional when I heard about it because
me too.
Growing up in the Top Gear era, I watched her on that van segment on the Nürburgring when I was probably when I was in like primary school, and she was a very just an amazing character to watch on screen and seemed like such a genuine person from all accounts that I've heard. So for somebody, as you both have said, she was such an inspiration, an icon, a trailblazer in the industry, and really was kicking it in the boys' club and was doing a great job of it. So to hear of her passing was just really sad, and, you know, hopefully she's inspired another generation of young women and more to really give it a crack and break barriers no matter which industry you're in.
I think I did read some interviews after I heard the news. I wanted to know a little bit more about her. And I think she said 13, she wanted to be a racing car driver. She certainly lived her dream. And I think she said she'd done 20,000 laps of the Nürburgring. And about, I think, 1 year she did 1,200.
Jeez.
So she would have known like that track like the back of her hand. It really blows my mind. Every time I get in a van, I channel my inner Sabine Schmitz, and I think about it every single time. So, yeah, I'll be thinking about it with some fondness next time I'll be doing that.
Go! The brake with my left foot.
Okay.
Then I can keep the right foot on the gas. See? 150! Hurry up, please. Woo! All the steer and understeer and everything. Bike in my way. English oak on the bike. Now the carousel is coming. Fasten your seatbelts. Faster! Slipstream, Mr. Slipstream, I'm coming! Closer, 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 closer. Woo! I must be crazy. No! No, please! 8 seconds left! No! No! Ah! Ah! 10-0! Race I ever had in my life.
Time for this week's news, and we start off with you, Moco. 7 Subaru dealers in Melbourne have stuck to fixed pricing.
Yeah, this is a great little story from Scott, an exclusive story from Scott. So, 7 dealers owned by the Trivet Retail Group in Melbourne have rolled out fixed prices on the back of a trial that it started last year. It's calling it the price pledge philosophy. And basically, prices are calculated based on the average discount given to buyers on a particular model, along with available stock. So if stock levels are good or demand is low, prices are likely to be lower. Now, Trivet is actually part of a company called Inchcape, which is also the independent distributor and importer of Subaru vehicles in Australia. It also distributes and imports Citroens and Peugeots as well. So it's quite interesting that it seems to me quite obvious that this is part of a wider trial and a wider experiment to have fixed no-haggle prices in dealerships. Now, this is just the latest in a series of moves that we've seen. Honda has radically changed its dealer network to an agency model, which basically means it owns all of the stock. Its dealers are simply transaction points and customer interface points, and prices are fixed. Mercedes-Benz is moving to a similar model this year as well. And I think you're seeing now more and more research showing that a lot of people are quite intimidated by traditional dealership experiences where they need to go in and they need to haggle because they worry that someone who's more of a, I guess, a shark, to use that, you know, particular metaphor, is going to get a better deal than them. And so while on the upper hand, if you're a good negotiator and a good haggler, you can get yourself a screaming deal. For a lot of people, it's actually quite an uncomfortable experience that's counterintuitive to other purchasing experiences. So this is the latest version of that. It's going to be super interesting to sort of sit back on our haunches in another year's time when we've got a bit more, I guess, exposure to various dealerships and brands doing the no-haggle pricing to get a feel for what the punters think. But yeah, look, I think it's really interesting. I think what will help this particular instance is that Subaru's loyalty is tremendously high. It's got one of the most loyal buyer groups around. People who buy Subarus love them to bits and are probably not going to buy anything else. So I think it advantages them to play with the fixed pricing model. But yeah, it'll be super fascinating to see what happens moving forward.
What are your thoughts on no haggle pricing, JO? Would it worry you if you bought a car where you couldn't negotiate with price?
Not necessarily. I think for me, it's more just having consistency. And I think in Australia, we've gotten so used to super competitive pricing, super competitive dealers that, you know, in some segments, some brands, that you can see some massive, massive price cuts and adjustments to make that sale. And I think what the challenge is going to be is that for a lot of people, they're going to go in there expecting to, you know, shave off a few thousand off the recommended retail price, and they're going to get a rude awakening when suddenly they can't do that anymore. And I think there's going to be a period where you'll see some brands like Mercedes-Benz and Honda and so on using this strategy, whereas other places you're not necessarily going to get that. There's just going to be a bit of a teething period, I feel, and some people are going to try and still shop around for the best deal while they can go to a dealer and negotiate. But also, we're living in a time right now where, you know, used car prices are through the roof. It's very hard for new car dealers to make any adjustments to pricing because they're either low on stock or they're really cutting it fine with margins. So it's probably just going to be the way of the industry moving forward anyway. Yeah. So I guess we just have to prepare for it, because you think about it, right? You buy an iPhone, for example, and they've had very fixed prices for a long time. And ages ago, you know, Samsung, you could buy at JB Hi-Fi for $400 less and they'd have sales all the time. Whereas now it's not really the case. So once everyone else catches on, I think everyone's just going to get used to it and they're just going to have to deal with it. And, you know, you might just buy a car online and pay the ticketed price with your credit card. But I think for now, while people can still shop around and do deals, it might be an issue for, you know, price conscious buyers.
I think it's a really good point you raise, Wongy, which is right now it is a seller's market. Demand is sky high post-COVID. There's stock shortages all over the place. And we are seeing prices of vehicles at pretty high points at the moment, be in the used or the new market. When that situation flips and there's more bargaining power in the hands of actual car buyers and consumers, it'll be really interesting to see. Now, theoretically, fixed pricing means you can offer discounts. It's just that they're standardized across all dealerships. But in reality, it may well be the case that individual dealers can be more nimble and more ready and willing to do those deals quicker. So it will be interesting to see how this model stacks up when the market conditions change. So right now, it's probably an easy time to introduce it, but it may not stay that way forever. So this is one of the most fascinating things in the industry to watch, I think, at the moment.
Absolutely. Okay, JWO, BMW's infotainment system, the iDrive 8, has been unveiled, and wow, looks pretty impressive.
Yeah, so BMW has revealed its latest generation of iDrive. It's kind of weird because I feel like iDrive 5 and iDrive 6 went on forever, and then iDrive 7's only been around for a couple of years and it's already been replaced. Yeah. So the new BMW iX, that wildly designed crossover that's all electric and, you know, about the same size as an X5, is going to debut the eighth generation of BMW's infotainment software. In the iX, it's going to combine a 14.9-inch central touchscreen, very specific measurement there, and a 12.3-inch digital instrumentation display. And looking from the images, it's not a complete overhaul of the user interface or the skins or whatever. It's very much an evolution of what we've currently got with some new features built in. So the new screen is going to have a pixel density of at least 200 pixels per inch, according to BMW, but we don't know too much more about the specifics. But for reference, for example, and the latest iPhone screens have about 460 pixels per inch, and a Samsung Galaxy S21 is about 515 pixels per inch. But the sizes of the displays are different, and obviously compared to other vehicles in the market, it's probably going to be quite high resolution and very pretty. They've changed also the controls that you use to control iDrive. So there's a very classic rotary controller and buttons scattered around it as before, but now they're like touch capacitive ones. So if you look at the story on carexpert.com.au, there's a photo of this center console in the iX that has like a wood panel with lit up icons and typeface and whatever to signify where the buttons are. So it's very like future age tech, where, you know, you think of some of the movies that we might have watched in the 90s and early 2000s, where, you know, the cool tech is just like a button on the wall, or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's also going to have machine learning to try and obviously learn some of the things that you do every day. So it might be able to personalize your experience by entering a destination that you frequently visit every day. So for us, Moco, it might be putting in the address of the office, or, you know, that, and you can also do over the air updates. So it's just sort of bringing the iDrive system in line with a lot of the latest infotainment systems that you're starting to hear from other brands. The over the air updates thing was really pioneered by Tesla. So they can do bug fixes and introduce new features and whatnot through that. So we're going to see the BMW iX in Australia before the end of the year. So I'm assuming we're going to see a lot of new BMW models start to introduce this. Perhaps the new i4 that was revealed this week will also debut that for the 4 Series lineup, and then we'll just slowly see it rolled out. But I'm assuming there will be different size screens, given that it will likely be rolled out across, right down from 1 series through to 8 series and iX and i4. So, but yeah, it seems to be a good development of the system, but obviously it's all nice to show pretty screenshots and talk about the features on paper, but it'll be more about how it integrates into day-to-day use and how the system performs on the go that will really be a measure of how good it is.
Now, Marco, I cannot believe this, but an electric MG SUV is actually a competitor to hot hatches. What's going on here?
Well, I don't know about that. I think that's a bit of cheeky wordplay on behalf of Scott Colley, who wrote this story, because, you know, acceleration is not the be-all and end-all of the hot hatch experience, is it? But anyway, true. Yes, the MG Marvel R, it's called. Strange name. It's actually been around China for a while. I did a trip to China a few years ago to Shanghai, and I saw this car then, but it's been updated and tweaked and modernized for Western markets. It's a three-motor EV crossover with a 4.9-second 0 to 100 time, which puts it, you know, right up there and thereabouts with a Tesla Model Y long range. And this is a really cool car. So we've seen MG recently introduce Australia's most affordable electric SUV, the ZS. It's just launched a plug-in hybrid version of its HS mid-sized SUV, which is the most affordable of its kind. And the Australian operation of MG is really desperate to get this car here as well, although it hasn't been confirmed. We're excited to see the potential of the MG Marvel R, and its performance would certainly excite Australian buyers, is what a company spokesman said when we asked them. So it has a 400-kilometre range WLTP test, an 80% DC public charge, takes about 30 minutes. It's got a 212 kilowatt and 665 newton meter output across its three motors. It's got a 19.4-inch touchscreen inside, which I think is staggering, along with a 12-inch digital instrument cluster. It looks the part. It looks really quite sleek and cool. And this is just another example of, you know, MG, which is, you know, the face brand, I suppose, of SAIC Motor, which is the Shanghai-based conglomerate and China's biggest auto brand. This is just another example of MG, you know, really focusing on becoming a global superpower, because this vehicle really does sort of fit into the market where a Ford Mustang Mach-E might, or a Tesla Model Y, or an endless number of electric SUVs that we're seeing rolling out now. And, you know, the average punter would guess that this came out of Wolfsburg or Stuttgart, not out of Shanghai. So I do hope it comes to Australia because no doubt its price will be so keen that it will kind of force more established brands to cut their prices. But yeah, pretty impressive what's happening there. And of course, China has the chance to be the world leader in EVs because EVs are massive there. It's the biggest electric car market in the entire world. And any perceptions around Chinese combustion products don't apply because, you know, when it comes to EVs, China's top of the pile. So yeah, I think this is the first of many that we see and probably the best thing MG's done to date. So really exciting product.
What do you think of it, Jaywo?
Look, to be honest, it's an interesting design, but the specs are obviously very competitive. I think that what MG does really well is, as Michael said before, is bringing a more affordable starting point for cars like this. I think the MG ZS is putting a lot of pressure on other manufacturers to either bring their prices down or bring a more competitive product within a similar bracket. And I think this is just going to do the same thing. So if they can bring this for, like, you know, 50 to 60 grand, it's with the outputs and the range that it's got, it's, and obviously the tech on board, it's got really cool design. It's really future age. It's doing the stuff that Tesla does, but what mainstream buyers can afford. So I think if they can bring that here and continue the trend that they've been doing lately, I think we could be seeing a lot of these on the road if they bring it here. So
yeah. Absolutely. And lastly, Jaywo, the 2022 Kia EV6 has been revealed. What is the EV6? I'm assuming it is an EV,
right? So on the topic of interesting-looking electric vehicles, Kia's revealed its first purpose-built electric vehicle on the Hyundai Motor Group eGMP platform. So it's not their first EV because they have the Kia Niro EV, which is a little crossover, which is actually coming to Australia in the coming months. So the EV6 is sort of like a mid-sized crossover shooting brake wagon sort of thing that's very out there in terms of styling for the Kia brand. It's very similar in terms of size and platform and specification to the not the Hyundai Ioniq 5, just the Ioniq 5 that was revealed a few weeks ago. So like the Ioniq, that's very similar in size to a Tucson or the latest Tucson, which is quite a bit bigger than the current one. The EV6 is going to be about the same size as the next generation Sportage, which is meant to be revealed and revealed quite soon. It's debuted a new design language. They're calling it the digital tiger nose up front, which when you look at it, I don't see a tiger nose at all. It looks like it looks like a noseless tiger. Maybe the eyes are there, but definitely not the nose. So I'm not sure no teeth. I don't know what's going on there. And then it kind of has this sport back shooting brake style roof line that extends into this really interesting tailgate and bumper design that has a wraparound LED tail light signature that sort of looks like it belongs on an Aston Martin DBX, but it's not quite. The DBX is already questionable from some angles, but this looks questionable from most angles. So it doesn't really fit in my mind. The front's quite sleek and sexy, whereas the back looks a bit like, you know, Predator calling home sort of thing. It's like a spaceshipy weird thing. So, but apparently it's a collaborative effort between Korea, Germany, and the US. So that might be why it's a bit of a hodgepodge of styles. I don't know. The inside's a lot more conventional in terms of the layout. It's got big screens, it's got a nice central display and a digital instrument cluster. It's got an interesting two-spoke steering wheel that looks like it's been taken straight out of a Genesis. And it's going to be quite large, as I said before, so it should have plenty of room for passengers and luggage. And it is going to have quite a bit of touch capacitive switchgear instead of physical buttons. So it seems to be the way of the industry at the moment where with all this digitized stuff, they don't want physical buttons. They want to make it all new age and spacey and, you know, you touch a panel of plastic or glass and it does something. But, you know, whether that's easy to do on the move is another thing. So there'll be a couple of variants on offer globally. We don't know, first of all, if it's coming here or which ones we're going to get. But like the Ioniq 5, there's a base model with a 58 kilowatt hour battery pack and a 135 kilowatt, 350 newton meter electric motor. Good for an 8.5 second run to 100 kilometers an hour. And for those who don't know, that's about the same as a entry-level level Volkswagen ID4 that is available in other markets. That'll be here in a couple of years. Then there's a flagship grade that is dual motor all-wheel drive, gets 173 kilowatts and 605 newton meters, and it does 0 to 100 in 6.1 seconds, which is about the same as a Hyundai i30N. So it's got hot hatch levels of performance. There's even a longer range version, again, which is more powerful and has a bigger battery. So it steps it up to 72.6 kilowatt hours and gets you 160 kilowatts and 350 newton meters in a real wheel drive version. So you can get a long range rear wheel drive, or you can get a more powerful 225 kilowatt, 605 newton meter version with the dual motor setup, which reduces that 0 to 100 time again to 5.1 seconds. So at that point, you're looking at like Countryman, JCW, you know, Tiguan R levels of performance. And in terms of range, which is probably more important for a lot of people, the long range single motor model can do up to 480 kilometers on the WLTP's test cycle. And it can support 800 volt fast charging when plugged into a DC fast charger. Yeah, a really interesting design. It's really out there, and hopefully we see it here, because like the MG that we spoke about earlier, I think it's really important that mainstream manufacturers like Hyundai and Kia start really pushing these vehicles, even though Australia's not a huge electrified market, just to try and get cars in the country, get people exposed to the technology. And hopefully that means that if we are trying to, you know, reduce emissions and sort of catch up with the rest of the world, namely Europe, that Australia has the products in the country and available to us that allow us to do that. So Kia's now taking their outwards, offering several different products. You're going to have hybrid, plug-in hybrid and electric vehicles within the space of the next 12 months. Hyundai's sort of pushing to do the same. And hopefully that means that other mainstream manufacturers are going to have to follow suit to try and compete. Because I think that one thing I'm really big on is consumer choice. Not everyone's going to work well with a hybrid, plug-in hybrid or electric vehicle, but the fact that you have all three on offer is a really good start, because it means that you can cater to all different types of buyer. Because, for example, a lot of rural or regional buyers aren't really going to be interested in an all-electric vehicle if they're going to have to travel long distances and spend hours charging them. And conversely, there are some people that live in the city that would really benefit from a plug-in hybrid or an electric vehicle and don't want a conventional petrol or diesel car. So I think the more that we see stuff like this, and the more that the Australian divisions of these manufacturers push to get these cars here, because it is an emerging sector of the industry here, I think that it can only be a good thing, and hopefully we can see an even more diverse range of options available to Australian customers.
Absolutely. We'd be keen to hear what you think of Kia's EV6. Hit the news link at carexpert.com.au and leave your thoughts in the comments below. Hello to you, Scott Colley.
Hello, guys.
We will get talking to you about two big SUVs for a comparison shortly, but let's talk about your opinion article about ANCAP. Now, I'm assuming this is coming off the back of, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, the Mitsubishi Express van was Australia's first zero-star safety ANCAP rating, and it left many confused and bewildered, and I'm no doubt you were one of them, Scully.
I was. It's a conversation that we've been having for quite a while now, but the Express really put it in the spotlight for a lot of people, me and the rest of the Car Expert office included. And it's essentially that ANCAP does really good work, but the way that it now rates cars and what's required for a five-star rating means you can end up in a weird situation where a car that is fundamentally safe in a crash has a zero-star rating, but it also is potentially safer than a car with a four-star rating like the Hyundai iLoad. What essentially has happened with the Express is, although it didn't blow anyone away with its physical crash performance, it sort of scored middling results for adult occupant protection and vulnerable road user protection. But because it doesn't have AEB, because it doesn't have a central airbag, because it doesn't have lane keeping assist, it got a zero-star rating from ANCAP. And what that means to me, and what I think it would mean to a lot of punters, is that this thing is an absolute death trap, that you shouldn't under any circumstances get in the car, and that if you crash, you will immediately die. But in reality, that's not quite the case. So what this story is arguing is essentially that although ANCAP is doing good work, because there's so much weight put on active safety now, and because these scores aren't just about how a car performs in a crash, it's time to split the ratings in half and to say, here's how a car performs when it's ran into a wall, and here's how it performs when it comes to having active safety systems, because that's more useful for punters in the long run.
Should ANCAP have tested the mechanically same Renault Trafic as well, even though it's only had a Euro NCAP rating, hasn't it?
It has. So, yeah, this story, we sort of haven't dived too deep into that, but it is a little bit confusing because the Express, although it was released last year in Australia as a new car, is mechanically identical to the Renault Trafic, which was released in 2014 and doesn't have an ANCAP safety rating, but does have a Euro NCAP rating from 2015. It scored 3 stars back then. It also goes up against a whole lot of cars that were tested under older protocols. So the Hyundai iLoad, for example, actually has a 4-star rating, but was tested under much more relaxed testing protocols and has none of the active safety equipment. So it's not going to stop you having a crash in the same way the Express isn't going to stop you having a crash. Nor is there any guarantee if it was tested under 2020 or 2021 protocols, it would do any better than the Express. But on paper, what people see is 4-star and 0-star. So the star rating is really, really good in that it allows people to look at something at a glance and they will be able to go, right, well, 5 is better than 3, 3 is better than 1. But we've now reached a point where maybe that's a little bit too simple, and short of making people look up the technical report and look up when a car was tested and what the rules were when it was tested, which we as journos do, but the average car buyer maybe doesn't, it's kind of hard to break down the difference between these ratings and understand why a car is a 0-star or a 1-star car when something that performs the same in a crash might be a 3 or a 4-star car.
Yeah, Scully, I'm really glad you covered this off, mate, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think the fundamental problem with ANCAP in this scenario is it assumes that everybody is as across the intricacies of the ratings as, well, we are in the media and as the people at ANCAP are. At the end of the day, the old Mitsubishi Express had no airbags, no stability control, no ABS, and the crumple zone was the front occupant. It was a 1-star car, and when you look at the picture of it crashing into a wall, whoever's in that car is dead. The new Express is a 0-star car, and whoever crashes into the wall has a pretty good chance of getting out of it alive. You know, the cabin is not looking too bad. The crumple zones have worked as they should. The airbags are deployed as they should. Now, ANCAP will say that, yes, but one is an older metric, one is a newer metric. But at the end of the day, as you've correctly said, the average punter just looks at the star rating. You can't say that, well, you need to dive in and look at the year rating and then compare and contrast. No, it's a comparative tool. And there needs to be a level of, you know, equivalence across all models, regardless of year that they're tested. And I think there's something a little bit more nefarious going on here too, which is that ANCAP needs publicity. It really does. It's the only way, you know, it's not a regulatory body. It doesn't control Australian design rules. The only way that it can really make sure it continues to get funding and get its message out there is to get attention. And I do sometimes wonder how much that played into the motivations, frankly, for giving this older Express a new test. I wonder if that plays a role. The whole thing is a bit fishy to me, and I think, you know, I'm not going to praise the Express's crash performance, but at the end of the day, I think it's a little bit fishy, and I think Mitsubishi's kind of been, well, maybe hauled over the coals a touch unfairly.
Just to follow up on Mike's comment, I reckon that, like you said, Moko, we've seen a couple of examples now where ANCAP's almost made an example of certain manufacturers. So we saw this a couple of years ago with the Stinger. You know, the base model is only getting a 3-star rating instead of because they didn't have AEB, or the Serato as well, and they made a really big song and dance about it, even though at the time there were several new models launched that instead of being actually tested and given an appropriate rating were sometimes tested against different protocols to Euro NCAP, for example. And I think just that it's the lack of consistency that is not only not a good look, in my opinion, but also can be really, as you said, can be really confusing to consumers. And, you know, in the case of the Express and the Trafic, for example, it's like, well, why did they bother even testing the Express now and not the Trafic when the Trafic's been on sale here for years and is fundamentally the same vehicle? So it just doesn't make sense that one has a horrible rating and the other doesn't. So it's just a lack of consistency, and it's confusing even for us covering it. It's like, well, why haven't you done this and why have you done that? But at the same time, I think that regardless of what the result was, the fact that the Express has been launched in 2020, regardless if it's 2020 or 2021, it's been launched with no active safety gear. It clearly is not a strong performer in a physical crash sense because the traffic didn't really get a good score in Euro NCAP testing either. So they have launched a commercial van that is several steps behind the competition when you look at like the Toyota Hiace, which has everything as standard and is a very good crash performer. So it's sort of like I can see both sides of the argument, and hopefully the negative commentary or the critical commentary from us and other outlets and from industry bodies hopefully means that there's a more consistent approach moving forward.
I think it's worth saying that ANCAP does really good work. And obviously the point of this isn't to take a massive swipe at ANCAP, because a lot of what it does is put safety in the spotlight and encourages car makers to bring the latest technology to Australia and encourages car buyers to search for that technology. So like the majority of what ANCAP's doing is really, really good work. But I think the reason that this has come about is all of a sudden we've reached a point, and the Express is probably the most easily visible example of it, where all of a sudden the crash test and the rating don't actually serve consumers in the way maybe they should. Because if ANCAP was all about making things clear for consumers and helping them choose the best new car possible and the safest new car possible, it would have tested the traffic, not the Express for one, because the traffic actually sells in better numbers than the Express, if my memory serves me correctly. But it also would then go through and crash test all the other vans it's up against. It sort of feels like in this case it's picked low-hanging fruit and gone for the headline, when in reality what it needs to be doing is trying to explain to customers, you know, what the safest van is, not just that the Mitsubishi is unsafe in 2021 based on new tests. And yeah, like James has said, we've seen some examples of that. So at the core of this is not so much, well, ANCAP is not doing a good job, because the work it does is really, really important and has put so many important things on the map for Australian car buyers. But if Aussie car buyers are at the core of what it's doing, and if serving Aussie car buyers and making clear to them what a safe car is in 2021 is their mission, then it just makes a lot of sense going forward for them to say, well, this car physically will do this for you in a crash, but it also lacks these active safety features. And it could be as simple as having 2 5-star ratings instead of one. It's a 3-star car in a crash, and it's a 0-star car when it comes to active safety, because that's still easy to market. That's still easy to put in a photo, which is what ANCAP does. And it's also an easy way to communicate to consumers how a car actually stacks up without trying to oversimplify it or without trying to make one part of safety the be-all and end-all, which is kind of what it's done here. Yeah, the Express won't help you avoid a crash, but it will still do something to protect you if you do end up in that accident. And that's just not clear from a 0-star rating.
If you'd like to read up on Scully's opinion piece, it is live now and at carexpert.com.au. All right, moving on, Scully, you have pitted Hyundai's and Mazda's biggest SUVs back-to-back, the Palisade and CX-9. Hyundai's Palisade's new, Mazda CX-9's been around for a little while. So why did you decide to compare these two?
Well, it was actually one of those conversations that Mike, James and I often have in the office, where we had the Palisade coming through and there was a new Mazda CX-9 Azami LE with the 6-seat interior, with a new infotainment system, and with a price tag that when you start looking at driveaway prices is almost identical to the Hyundai's. So it really feels like a natural matchup, because these are both the nicest, most expensive, most spacious SUVs you can buy from these two brands. And they both take very different sort of approaches to carrying a family around in style.
Ooh, okay. So what are these approaches? I'm intrigued.
So the Mazda has a really interesting setup. For 2021, Mazda's added the Azami LE to the range, and it's got a 6-seat interior with two essentially business class captain's chairs in the second row. They have got heating, cooling, they've got power adjustment and a center console between them. The Hyundai, although it's actually a little bit smaller than the Mazda on the outside when you look at its pure dimensions, is boxier inside. You can get it with captain's chairs in the middle, but they don't have the same center console. It's more of a sort of practical approach to carrying a lot of people around, but it still has a lot of luxuries. It's still got Nappa leather seats. It's still got the full spread of stuff the Mazda does. It just doesn't try so hard to be lavish or luxurious, a little bit more pared back and a little bit more focused on the actual people hauling side of things. So the Mazda's a bit nicer, but the Hyundai's a little bit more spacious.
What's the price difference?
So the Mazda has the cheaper list price. It's listed at $73,875 before on-road costs, whereas the Hyundai Palisade Highlander with the turbo diesel engine is $75,000. That gap actually does narrow down though, because when you look at the drive-away prices for a Melbourne postcode listed on the websites, The Hyundai's 77,830 drive away and the Mazda's 76,985 drive away. So at that sort of price where a lot of people are financing these cars, there's very little to separate them.
Scully, one of the big differences between these two, of course, are drivetrains. Talk us through the differences in engines, mate.
So although Hyundai does offer a petrol V6 engine, it's front-wheel drive only, and it's more of a basic powertrain. The top-spec car we've got here has a 2.2-litre turbo diesel engine, and that comes with all-wheel drive as standard. Hyundai said that although you can get a petrol all-wheel drive overseas, packaging it for right-hand drive just isn't an option. The engine in the Hyundai has 147 kilowatts of power and 440 newton metres of torque, and it's got an 8-speed automatic. The CX-9 was originally launched as an American market-focused car, and that means there's no diesel option. But on paper, it's actually quite similar to the Hyundai. It's got a 2.5-litre turbocharged petrol engine, and it's got 170 kilowatts of power and 420 newton metres of torque, and it's a 6-speed auto. So although they take very different approaches to getting there, both these cars have 2.2 or 2.5-litre four-cylinder engines, and both are within a stone's throw of each other when it comes to torque.
Now, we're well familiar with Mazda's ambition to be kind of a semi-premium brand. It's not like an Audi or a Mercedes-Benz or even a Lexus, but it definitely goes above and beyond when it comes to material quality and tactility and NVH suppression and things like that. So we know that's going to be a pretty plush place to spend time and to have your kids. But what about the Hyundai? I mean, this looks like a Yank tank, but does it actually match the Mazda when it comes to luxury and refinement and all those sorts of things?
So the Hyundai takes a very different approach to the Mazda. Everything in the Mazda, and the word you've used previously, Moco, that I really like is quietude. The Mazda is focused on making a real sort of smoker's lounge vibe. It's got dark wood trim on the doors and on the transmission tunnel. All of the buttons are very neatly arranged, and the driver sits in this sort of quilted back brown leather seat. The Hyundai doesn't do that because it was, again, primarily aimed at the US and the Korean markets before it was Australia. And that means it's got a big, flat, wide center console. It's got big, chunky buttons up on the dash. It sort of feels like you're at the flight deck. it definitely doesn't feel as plush or as refined as the Mazda, but it also isn't all that far behind because when you actually spend time in the car, for me, the materials are just as good. The center transmission tunnel, the material on there feels like real metal. It's cold to the touch when you get in. It's got Nappa leather seats and a suede headliner. And although I'm not normal size, JWO, I know you've reported as well that the seats in the CX-9 are a little bit short under your thigh, whereas the Palisade, it's like they were designed with Lazy Boy. They are so comfortable. the Mazda definitely has a more old-fashioned approach to luxury, but The Hyundai's not that far behind when it comes to material quality, and when it comes to actually spending a lot of time in the car, I would argue it's the better of the two.
So, Scott, before you mention the powertrain, so just taking one question back, but so obviously a lot of the main contenders in that large SUV segment from a mainstream perspective tend to have large capacity petrol engines, and the CX-9 was a little bit different in offering a turbocharged four. Now you've got the Palisade with the diesel, and you know a lot of people are starting to argue these days that the diesel's dead, but in a car this size I feel that the relaxed talky nature of a diesel, even a four-cylinder one, would be a good fit for something this large. And given I've spent a bit of time in both the current and the previous generation Kia Carnival with the same engine, I feel like would be pretty good. How do you compare the character and the performance of the diesel versus the turbo petrol in the CX-9 and the Palisade?
So I think of the two engines you can get in the Palisade, the diesel is definitely the better one. It's got more power down low. The transmission doesn't need to shuffle through the gears as much, so it feels more effortless, which is obviously in keeping with a more luxurious car. But I actually, and it's also more efficient before I go on there. We did a long drive and it did about 250Ks on the highway with two people on board, and it averaged around 7 litres per 100Ks, which for a massive family bus is really, really impressive. Mm. The Mazda can't match that efficiency. On a long highway road trip last year, I averaged 9 litres, although that was fully loaded with some mountain driving. But I would argue it's actually the nicer engine of the two because it's been tuned not to feel like a diesel but to deliver a really strong low-down torque. It actually is kind of diesel-like in that it's relaxed, it pulls hard from just off idle, but it also has more power at the top end. So it kind of does the surfing around town stuff just as effortlessly as the Hyundai, But when you really put your foot down and need to get a move on, where the Hyundai kind of has adequate performance, it'll do it. It'll get you there. It doesn't really feel like it wants to be doing it necessarily. The Mazda pulls a little bit harder and has a bit more in reserve. So the Hyundai is the more practical of the two. It's the more efficient engine, but the Mazda engine, I would argue, is actually nicer and is also a little bit more refined. It doesn't vibrate as much. It's got start-stop where the Hyundai doesn't. So, yeah, the Hyundai is the smarter choice, but not necessarily the nicer choice on that regard.
Scully, just one final one from me here, which is that we often say that if you got a tribe of five kids, just buy a Kia Carnival, buy a Volkswagen Multivan, stop trying to keep up with the SUV crowd and just get a bloody MPV because it's better. But if, you know, you do have five kids and you're desperate to have an SUV and you need to use that third row more than just occasionally, do either of these actually stack up? And if so, which is the better one?
So we've got a couple of photos in this story of the Palisade and the CX-9 side by side. And looking at the two of them, it's really, really clear that the Palisade is essentially just a van that's been raised up a little bit. It's got a really boxy profile, a really boxy roofline. And that means that it is definitely the more practical of the two when it comes to loading people in. For starters, even though our tester had the standard three-seat central bench, even when you get a two-seat captain's chair set up in the middle, it's got more seats than the Mazda because the Mazda is a two-seater in the third row and the Hyundai is a three-seater. Sort of working from the back forward, the third row in the Hyundai, although you wouldn't want to sit three wide there, has more leg room and more headroom than the Mazda. And then the second row, although the Mazda's business class chairs are really, really nice, and if you are a kid, they'll feel like it'll be like Christmas every time you get in because there's buttons to press and there's cup holders and there's armrests and there's lots of exciting stuff. I would argue that the Hyundai has better leg room when the captain's chairs are installed. And the way that Hyundai's done its second row captain's chairs is that you still get heating and ventilation and that sort of thing, but you've got a walk-through sort of gap to the third row. And that essentially means that if you do want to have two child seats or three child seats in a car, you can have two on the middle row and without having to take the child seat out and fold them, still access the third row by walking through the middle. Although the Mazda's approach is more plush, it feels really luxurious back there. If you are going to have child seats in there or you want to access the third row regularly, it's a little bit more difficult to do it because although the seats slide and fold forward, that center console doesn't. Removing that six-seat setup from the equation, even if you go with the normal CX-9 where it's got a three-row bench in the middle and then a two-row bench behind it, legroom in the second row is really good but not quite as good as the Palisade. And the Palisade just feels that little bit wider and taller because it is so boxy. So although the Mazda is more luxurious and it's more interesting back there, it's really cool having buttons to press and things to do. Apples for apples, with two seats in the middle row, like captain's chairs, I would argue the Hyundai is the more practical and not all that much less luxurious. And when you compare three-row benches in the middle, the Hyundai has it covered as well. It is probably as close as you can get to a people mover on stilts without actually just buying a Kia Carnival. Although, I mean, the adage is still the same. If you really want to carry a lot of people around, buy a people mover because although the Palisade is good, you then drive a Carnival and realize that it's better again when it comes to lugging people around.
Mm. All right, Scully, we'll wrap this up. Which one did you give the win to?
So although the Mazda is a nicer car, the Hyundai is a better family car and that has narrowly taken the win.
Okay, that comparison is up at carexpert.com today. You, Scott Colley, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
All right, welcome, Derek Fung, live from the US. How are you going?
I'm going well as I can, given all this pandemic.
I've sort of forgotten a little bit of what that's like in Australia. We're not really in lockdown that much anymore. You guys have it a bit tougher over there.
I am trying to find myself a vaccine, and it is very hard. I saw a thunderbird today, and that seemed less rare than a vaccine.
Well, while you've been in lockdown and spending a lot of time at home, you've done a really, really cool in-depth piece about global vehicle sales. So, Mike, you're very familiar with VFACTS, and so am I. We do a lot of coverage every month. But Derek's done this awesome piece detailing 2020's sales results across the globe. So, Derek, did you find anything interesting? What happened? Who's the winner? Who's the losers? Tell us more.
Well, I guess the winners were pretty obvious from the start. It was going to be Toyota, Volkswagen, Renault, Nissan, Mitsubishi in third place. I guess the interesting thing for me was just how heavily reliant certain brands or companies are on specific markets. So Subaru deriving 71% of its sales from the US is just mind-blowing to me. And the former Group PSA getting 85% of sales from Europe shows why it really, really wanted that merger with Fiat Chrysler.
Man, I've been obviously covering the industry side of things for ages, and it can be a real pain in the ass tracking down sales figures from brands. I mean, there's no standardized global database of vehicle sales. Every country has better tallies and more accurate tallies than others. How the hell did you find all this information? What was the main tool you used to actually come across these global sales figures?
Well, most of these companies are public companies, so they have to put filings in every quarter. And with that, they break down their sales. So you just have to trawl through that. And I guess the problem is not so much getting an overall tally of each company, but how they break it down. So if you have a company that's just one brand, then it's not too hard to, or maybe one brand with the smaller luxury brand. It's not too hard to deduce where the sales are coming from. But with like all these different companies, they break things down in different ways. So Volkswagen went into a lot of detail by brand, by region. And Ford gave us information a little bit by brand. And then you just kind of had to work everything out yourself. But it still didn't give any model breakdowns. It didn't give a breakdown between Ford and Lincoln. So there's one commenter in there who was asking about global F-150 sales, and I just don't know. Like, I'd have to troll some blogs that specialize specifically in car sales to do that. And do I have the time and the mind space to do it?
Derek, mate, sometimes finding data and numbers can be a real pain. There's no centralized global database of top-selling car brands. It's often market-specific, brand-specific. What was your process to actually find all this data?
Well, all these companies are publicly listed, so they have to put in filings to their respective stock exchanges every quarter. So I just built it out off of that. I guess the hard thing was every company tallies their sales in slightly different ways. Some of them have figures that include leases and don't include leases and stuff like that. And also the way that companies break down their data varies quite wildly. So Volkswagen went into a lot of detail per region, per brand, whereas Ford only did per region. It didn't give any details about how many Fords or Lincolns it sold. It didn't give any breakdowns as to models either. So one commenter was asking about how many F-150s were sold across the world, and I could come up with a guesstimate, but I would be missing a whole bunch of sales from Latin America and maybe China as well.
Maybe for the benefit of the listeners, we should actually run through the top 10 conglomerates, dude. So what actually were the top 10 car, I won't even say car brands, I'll say car groups or car conglomerates. What were the top 10?
So it was Toyota. So that includes Toyota, Daihatsu and Lexus on top on 9.3 million. And second was the Volkswagen group with 9.1 million. So that covers everything from Volkswagen, Seat, Skoda, all the way up to Bugatti. Number three, and I was kind of loath to group them together because they kind of work so autonomously, but Renault Nissan Mitsubishi Alliance was 7.8 million. So that's the top three. And then just running through the rest is GM in fourth place, the Hyundai Motor Group in fifth place. So that's Hyundai, Kia, Genesis, Stellantis, which is Fiat Chrysler and Group PSA in sixth place, Honda in seventh, Ford in eighth, Daimler, which is basically Mercedes-Benz and a little bit of Smart at ninth place. And then I guess the surprise for everybody was Suzuki in 10th place.
Super surprising, and mostly down to India, where I noticed that about half of every vehicle that Suzuki sold for last year was sold in India. So you mentioned before that Subaru was 70% United States. Suzuki, 50% India. Are there any other brands that you found that were surprisingly reliant on just one market?
Yeah, there were. Obviously, well, I don't know whether I mentioned this already, but Group PSA gets 85% of its sales from Europe. And I guess GM is also very heavily reliant on the North America / China axis.
Well, they've pulled out of everywhere else.
Yeah, that everywhere else except for Latin America. That's basically their jam right now. I guess the other thing that I found interesting was China is obviously a very important market, but there are a few automakers that are kind of really missing in the game, and that's Stellantis, which used to have quite a decent presence there, but just like Jaguar Land Rover, they had a lot of product and quality issues there, and that's really driven down sales. And Renault is a very small player there as well, and Subaru is probably the only brand I covered there that doesn't have a joint venture partner, so it doesn't sell. It sells maybe 20,000, 30,000 cars there. I don't have the exact figures on hand, but it sells barely any in a market that's, well, the world's largest.
I think the other thing that this story really showed me is the sort of thing that we try to explain to a lot of our readers, which is that Australia is actually kind of almost a rounding error in the global scheme. Like, we're quite an inconsequential market. There are some brands like Mazda, for instance, where we actually are pretty important. But you have a look at the global sales, and then you have a look at what component of that Australia made up, and it's often ridiculously tiny. And I think one of the things that this story was really good for was to remind me that, yeah, we get caught up in Australia and it matters to us, but on a global sense, we're almost a rounding error.
In preparation for this podcast, and I might actually split this off into an article one day, I kind of looked at Australian sales as a percentage of global sales. Now, this isn't like a final thing because I wanted to break it down by brand and I haven't quite gone that far yet. But Mitsubishi gets 7.1% of its sales from Australia. So that's the highest percentage I could find. That's followed by Mazda, which was 6.89%. And then you have Subaru at 3.5% and then Toyota at 2.57%. So, and then you kind of go down from there. Kia, Hyundai are about 2% each.
Well, I think that really reinforces some of the product rollouts that we see. We've seen Mitsubishi actually do world premieres in Australia, Mazda as well. There are some brands where it takes, you know, Volkswagen, for instance, it takes them a year and a half sometimes to get a car to Australia after the global launch, whereas Mitsubishi and Mazda, it tends to get here very quickly. And when you have a look at the way that they, you know, what their Australian divisions contribute to their global divisions, it actually makes a heck of a lot of sense. So a story like this from an Australian perspective really gives you an idea of why some brands seem to have greater pull than others. Was there anything else that when you were, you know, spending copious amounts of time pulling this together really shocked you or surprised you? Was there something else that made you kind of sit back and go, maybe that can't be right? I think I have to double check these figures.
One that I found was that Jaguar Land Rover sells more cars than its parent brand Tata, which I found crazy because, you know, the Tata Group in India is a big thing. It's a conglomerate that spans so much of, well, so many different industry segments across the country, yet its automotive arm is actually quite small. And when you think about it in context with Suzuki taking 50% of the market, Hyundai another 10-15%, and then you go down from there, Tata is really, really small compared to the luxury brand that it bought. And the other thing that I noted down here was that I'm surprised how long Proton has stayed alive, given that it only sells 100,000 cars a year and they're not exactly high-end or profit-rich models. The fact that it survived as an independent brand for so long before being bought out by Geely a few years ago does kind of strike me as a little bit odd. I guess one other thing that I've noticed, just going through the numbers one more time, is that Toyota is by far the world's most popular brand. It's got almost 8 million sales, with Volkswagen, I think, in second place at 5.3 million, followed by either Ford or Nissan at about 4 million each, and then Hyundai at 3.6. And I guess that really shows the value of was a huge contribution that like the other brands play in the Volkswagen group.
Well, that's really interesting stuff. And thank you again, Derek, for your time. You can read the rest of that article at carexpert.com.au. Thank you for joining us.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
That is a wrap. Joe, Costello's like, nah, sick of you guys. I'm out of here. But in all honesty, he was working remotely in a D-Max and didn't have anywhere to charge his laptop. And the software we used to record the podcast chews through laptop battery like no tomorrow. So he had 3% on his laptop battery before we said goodbye to him. So, all right, we'll go through a couple of things before we wrap up. What cars have we got coming up next week?
So in the garage, we have quite a few things coming through. So we've got the new Hyundai Santa Fe Highlander, the Mazda CX-8 Asahi LE, which has that same six-seat layout as the CX-9 that Scott compared, which is going live shortly too. We have the new Citroen C3 hatchback. We have a BMW 330i luxury line and a Lexus IS30 F-Sport. In Sydney, we'll have the new Subaru Outback in a different specification to the one we had on the launch. And in Brisbane, we have an Audi RS3 sedan. We also have quite a few launch reviews going live this coming week. So a couple of things to look forward to and stay tuned. So Anthony Crawford is joining Peugeot for a launch of their updated SUV range. So the new Peugeot 3008 and 5008 have finally arrived in Australia, and we're getting an early drive of those. So they're coming up on the 25th of March, which is Thursday. And I recently joined Mercedes-Benz on the launch of the AMG GLE 63S wagon and coupe, as well as the AMG E53 coupe and cabriolet. So,
nice.
Yes, it was a very fun event. I can't unfortunately talk about driving impressions until next week.
I was gonna ask you that.
Yeah, so they're also the 25th and 26th for the GLE and E-Class respectively, but I'm very excited to write those reviews and tell everybody how it went. Oh, I nearly dropped an adjective in there, which is not allowed. So we've got some really cool launch reviews coming up in the next week. So plenty to look forward to.
Yeah, we'll have to get you on the podcast next week when that embargo lifts to talk about some of those models. Sounds really cool. Well, I would say thanks to Mike Costello, but he's not here, so I won't. James Wong, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.